When cartoonist Ken Krimstein set out to do a graphic biography of Hannah Arendt, all sorts of questions came to mind.
She was a brilliant, genius philosopher. And at one point, she just renounces philosophy. She says, no. I'm like, why would you do that? Why would she always seem to be in the center of everything that was happening, whether it was Weimar Germany with people like Billy Wilder and Bertolt Brecht and, you know, all these influential artists who were creating the modern world and scientists? And what was the nature of her courage?
We talk with Krimstein about Hannah Arendt, her life, her work, and her importance for our time. His book is The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt. Then we listen back to my 2015 interview about another brilliant German-Jewish woman of the 20th century, revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg. We talk with Kate Evans about her graphic biography, Red Rosa. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Hannah Arendt is best known for her book about the trial of Adolf Eichmann, Eichmann in Jerusalem, A Report on the Banality of Evil. But she had a long and illustrious history as a brilliant philosopher and political thinker before then. Having fled Nazi-occupied Europe for the U.S., she wrote the seminal work Origins of Totalitarianism. She coined the word totalitarianism and said its foundation is built on the contempt for facts and the elevation of lies. Ken Krimstein began writing his graphic biography of Arendt before Donald Trump's successful campaign for president, but as you'll hear, he feels Arendt's life is an inspiration and her work a warning for us today as we strive to prevent totalitarianism from taking hold here. Well, Ken Krimstein, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book was absolutely terrific. I learned so much. The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt. A Tyranny of Truth. A Tyranny of Truth?
Yeah. Well, A Tyranny of Truth. I mean, this was a woman who had an incredible drive to stare reality in the face. And one of the things that made me, I had to figure out why. Why did this woman sacrifice her friends and so much to call it like she saw it? And as I was working on it, I almost called her a virulent truth teller. And she just couldn't, it's not like I cannot tell a lie. She felt that lies actually tore the fabric of the world. They destroyed the world. You know, and I was curious, what made a person like this? Was it the events of her life? Was she born that way? So yeah, A Tyranny of Truth. This was, we usually think of tyranny as being lies, but she was as passionate about that as telling the truth of the world as she saw it, or reality, as she saw it, reality. So, yeah.
And what drew you to her in particular?
You know, what drew me to her was initially just a fascination with what I would call the average NPR listener's knowledge of her. Banality of evil. Well, what an interesting phrase. What does that mean? I think I know what that means. Origins of Totalitarianism, wow, you know, what a weighty tome, you know, that I carried around with me when I was in high school and I could never read. And a very, you know, and she smoked a lot and she seemed really cool. So, you know, I was fascinated to dig a bit deeper into this character because I was looking in my art to find a way to take complex ideas or philosophical ideas and translate them. And when I opened the page one of the biography of this woman, to dig in, every single fact, every nuance, every person she met, every incident she had seemed to resonate with me to the point that I felt like, you know, with all due respect to my mother, this may have been my mother, or this is the person I want to hang out with. And I had questions. I was consumed the more I knew. Like, she was a brilliant, genius philosopher, I would argue. And at one point, she just renounces philosophy. She says, no. I'm like, why would you do that? Why would she always seem to be in the center of everything that was happening, whether it was Weimar Germany with people like Billy Wilder and Bertolt Brecht and, you know, all these influential artists who were creating the modern world and scientists? And what was the nature of her courage? So I guess I was smitten. I was smitten and I needed to answer the question, Hannah Arendt question mark.
Well, let's start at the beginning. Tell us about Hannah Arendt's background and the milieu in which she grew up.
Yeah, well, she grew up in a, I say in the book, she grew up in a lost world in another time. I mean, she was raised in a country that no longer exists, a part of a country that no longer exists called East Prussia, which is a little spit of Germany that sticks out because it has a seaport. And she was born in a city called Königsberg, which no longer exists. And when cars were just getting started and you know, they were rumbling over cobblestone streets, and just to jump ahead, she dies in Manhattan on the Upper West Side after the Ramones have started gigging and Nixon has long resigned. So I'm like, well, this is quite an arc. But so she's from Königsberg. And, you know, as I was working on the book, because I really wanted to get the facts and stories right, all these synchronicities started coming up. So Immanuel Kant was also, this philosopher who was so influential to her and so much modern philosophy, also strode the streets of Königsberg. And so she was from a secular Jewish family, didn't even really know she was Jewish until some kid in school started yelling at her, "You're a Jew," and she comes home and asks her mom, "What's a Jew?" You know, and her mom says, "It's a religion." And in the book, I have her say, "Well, we don't go to a Jutheran church," because, you know, she's a kid. But she has to deal with a lot of tragedy early in her life. Her father dies of syphilis, and a particularly kind of in those days, it would make you insane. And then, you know, Hannah's response, and again, forgive me for calling her Hannah, but I lived with her in her mind for so long, I felt I got to, I kind of bonded with her. But her response at sort of age 8 or 9 is, as I say, the typical 8 or 9 year old's response. First of all, she tells her mother, "Well, you know, there's nothing we can do with it, Mom. It happened," you know, comforting her mother. And then she says, "And by the way, can you get me all of Dad's Immanuel Kant books down off the shelf?" And she proceeds to read all this philosophy and then teach herself ancient Greek and then start an ancient Greek performance club, you know, as a teen will do. So I'm like, whoa, what's up? So she is very smart and she goes to university at 17 and a half. And there is a genius philosopher who's attracting all the smartest students all across Germany, including most of the smartest Jewish students. It was a very different situation. So not only did Hannah Arendt go to Marburg to study with this guy, but people like Emmanuel Levinas, who became a very prominent philosopher. I mean, I had to read up on a lot of these people, but I saw them. Herbert Marcuse, Hans Jonas, and many other people.
Leo Strauss. Yeah. I just found it interesting. Herbert Marcuse, who was a brilliant media critic, you say, although I think that's like it much more elevated than that, thinker and philosopher on the left. Leo Strauss, right, who basically started the whole neoconservative movement in the United States.
I mean, the people who spun off of this classroom in Marburg, there was Hans Jonas, who basically invented, you know, the study of Gnosticism, Strauss, right, Marcuse, who was at Brandeis, Karl Loewith, who was a philosopher, but he was nominated for the Nobel Prize in Literature. I mean, these were all students of Heidegger. And of course, Martin Heidegger was the teacher, by the way, in case I didn't mention that. And Hannah Arendt was there. So, yeah, the sparks that came off of this, whatever Heidegger was doing in that classroom, which was supposedly pretty remarkable. I did not know, and some of your listeners may know, some may not, that there was a very, shall I say, notorious, long-hidden affair between Hannah and Martin Heidegger when she was quite young, which the heat of the affair appears to have only lasted about a year and a half, but there was a long-standing and complicated relationship between the two of them throughout their lives. But that factors into the story. But anyway, she gets this incredible sort of education, and then this is in the 1920s, the Roaring Twenties. She leaves there, and then she ends up in Weimar, Berlin, at the absolute height of that moment in history. And one of the things I did in the book, and, you know, it's funny, people either love it or I wouldn't say hate it, but don't get it. all due respect here to the English, I put tons and tons and tons of little tiny footnotes in there because I also teach and I have kids, and I want them, if they read about, like you said, like Leo Strauss or somebody, they should have a little bit of context. It's interesting. So she ends up in Weimar in Berlin at this incredible moment of cafe society, but there's this crazy fact happening of the rise of fascism at the same time. So, you know, I'm going to, but I mean, this is incredible again. And the thoughts were big and art and, you know, and I was like, I was starting to question, like, you know, what was going on in German culture at that time that, you know, they were reinventing time and space and physics and art and film and chemistry and politics.
And it was largely, not entirely, but largely Jews who were doing that. I mean, that's one thing that really struck me in the book, because almost every person you talk about, you know, include in Berlin, for example, you know, these were Jewish thinkers. I mean, there was Albert Einstein, obviously. It was Walter Benjamin, who I want to talk about a little bit more in a moment. But why do you think there was this kind of incredible flowering of Jewish thinkers and artists and writers just on the cusp of the abyss, as I guess Hannah Arendt would have called it?
Absolutely. Well, that was, again, something that I discovered. And I think at that time, Berlin, you have to kind of think back. And I saw a statistic recently in 1930, which was around sort of the height of this time, there were, I believe, 140 daily newspapers published in Berlin, 140 daily newspapers, some of them with three daily editions. I mean, this was the most literate city in the world. It's an island in Germany. It was where, you know, there was a Jewish mayor of Berlin. I think it was a real flowering of this emancipated Jewish culture, and I think it caused a lot of resentment of among other people, but, you know, I don't know, but it's sort of everywhere you turned. I mean, to the point where, Francesca, this is kind of funny, but I had a scene and I wanted to show something about sort of the decadence. There was a lot of decadence in Weimar Berlin, as we know, along with all the greatness. And, and I thought, wow, I just have a hunch that a German Jew invented the modern condom. I don't know why. It was just one of those hunches. It's like, so I did what all kind of probably writers do these days. I went to the Google, and sure enough, yeah, it was Julius Fromm, who was a Polish refugee, went to Germany, went to night school in chemistry, and invented the modern condom. And, you know, I'm like, oh, well, I knew it. And in fact, his story is mentioned, is just hinted at in the book, but it's quite a remarkable and sad story as well. But yeah, there was the publishing houses, cinema, the sciences. So yeah, there was this epicenter. And not to say that there were, you know, Marlene Dietrich and there were others, you know, who weren't Jewish, but it was kind of an assimilated Jewish, you know, it was almost like it was like maybe New York City in the 50s or 60s. It was an amazing there was a cafe there called the Café Romaniche, and it was, you know, Billy Wilder, there's a quote from Billy Samuel Wilder, who went on to direct Some Like It Hot and The Apartment and Double Indemnity. And Wilder, he said that, you know, the Romaniche Café, he said even when he started making money, he still wanted to go there, to slum there. I mean, this is, you can only imagine, and Hannah had the best seat at the best table.
Right. You say in all of history, there was never a place like it. Or maybe she said that. I'm not sure because this
No,
is...
I say that. Okay. I say that. Because, you know, I get to narrate it. Mm-hmm. But maybe she's saying it through her voice because I have her narrating.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
And I don't think there was. In fact, I was lucky enough to be in Berlin over the summer. And I went into actually the Jewish Museum there, and I was looking, and I noticed there were a lot of books on Hannah Arendt and Benjamin and all these people. And I was talking to the woman at the counter selling the books, and I said, do you happen to know where the Café Romaniche is? And she said, oh, it's long gone. I said, oh, you know of it? She said, I was a literature major in German literature. So they study it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I imagine it's like Café Procope or whatever when the Enlightenment philosophers were there. It's gone. It's long gone.
Yeah. If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with cartoonist Ken Krimstein about his graphic biography of Hannah Arendt. You know, the same group of people then moved to Paris when, you know, Hitler took over, basically. Yeah. And one person who was in the same circle in both places, and in Berlin and then later in Paris, was Walter Benjamin, who's one of my totally favorite writers. Just a brilliant, eclectic thinker, sui generis. Tell us about
him. Yes, exactly. Well, Walter Benjamin, I like to say I was part of that cadre of East Village, you know, people who, when his book, I think it was translation of Reflections or Observations or something like that, came out and hit the St. Mark's bookstore, you know, we all picked it up and carried it around and read it, because Benjamin, sui generis is the way to describe him. I mean, he was a thinker. He was a freelance thinker who looked at culture and society and just kind of turned it inside out. And his thinking, you know, so much of his criticism and thought is so influential. He wrote Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. He asked, you know, right, what is the authenticity of art in there? He wrote about language. He wrote about theater.
Say something about the Art in the Era of Mechanical Reproduction. I mean, it's really about what happens when you can copy art.
Right.
And he almost prefigured the digital age in that thinking, although he was talking about photography.
Yeah, but he saw that, you know, the age of mechanization, which was happening. He talks, he's kind of a mystic. I mean, his great friend, and again, these networks of people, if you're only sort of like me, you know, kind of like, you know, fairly good Trivial Pursuit player, you know, sort of college degree, you know, his great friend was Gershon Scholem, who basically wrote the book on Kabbalism and mysticism. And Scholem says, there are many things are said of Benjamin, but he says he was like a secular mystic, because he was a failed communist because he was too much into art. So he was like, what's the nature? Like, why does art move you? You know, does seeing the actual Mona Lisa give you more of a sense of the aura than a reproduction of it? So he has all these questions, and he's just completely fascinating. And then another tiny, you know, as you're doing this, these little connections, turns out that Benjamin is the first cousin of Hannah's first husband. So I assume that he's probably at her first wedding.
And they were all friends.
And Benjamin was great friends with Bertolt Brecht. So Benjamin's really interesting project that I think a lot of people, you know, kind of got consumed with was he did this thing called the arcades. And what he did was he called himself a flaneur. He would just walk around. And, you know, of course, this is the idol of everybody, except that he happened to also write like a master and think. But he walked around. He ambled around. And he looked for little bits and pieces and scraps and things. And he tried to recreate Paris in the 19th century. And he thought by doing this collage kind of image of Paris in the 19th century, he would have expressed a type of history that is more real than what these people might have talked about as the great man version of history, you know, general to general to general, progress, progress, progress. All these people were very suspicious of that. And Hannah became a great friend of his. In fact, Hannah ended up meeting her second husband at his salon. And the two of them, Hannah and Walter Benjamin, used to go to the Bibliothèque Nationale and just sort of study in the day. And then Hannah would go try and save Jewish children in the night. And then she'd go home and like fight with her mother and her husband in the evening. And it's just, you know, but Benjamin was, you know, he merits so much reading in terms of the way that he has this incredibly fresh look at like why art or life should matter. So Hannah's very influenced. And in fact, their paths cross again later in the story when they're all sort of wind up in Marseille in a very sort of Casablanca moment where they're all trying to get letters of transit. And this is all true. I mean, they're literally the stuff that they did in the movie Casablanca about letters of transit and planes and all that was pretty much what was happening in Marseille. It was very, very, there was a very limited amount of visas that the U.S. was giving to people. And there was a guy named Varian Fry, who was an American journalist, and he worked very hard to try and get people out. But it was pretty tragic, and Hannah managed to get one of the last boats, and in a coda or sidelight to that, Benjamin, who's highly sensitive, loses his, he tries to pay, it sounds familiar to what's going on today, smugglers, to get him over the border. He's impatient, waiting for his letter of transit. And, you know, with his incredible bad luck, he lands on the always porous Spanish border between Spain and France on the one day the guards are there. And Benjamin is so despondent, he takes his life. So
I know that's...
all these paths cross. And but before Benjamin does do that, he gives Hannah his final opus, which is called The Theses on the Philosophy of History, which sounds really heavy, but it's really like 2 pages long of just, you know, sort of aphorisms. And it's really a remarkable document that a lot of people have written about. So I felt there's a connection between Hannah Arendt's thinking and her close friendship with Walter Benjamin. And that interested me because while I'm not, you know, I teach communication and I'm a writer and I'm a cartoonist, I'm interested in how ideas populate themselves and how they affect. And I thought that Hannah said everything is about action, you know, and that's why she was so well suited, I thought, to a graphic rendition. But for her, really interestingly, and I think Benjamin would agree, actions like what we witness, like movements and stuff, is all that counts. But words are also actions. The things we say, you know, anything that can be experience between people. So, you know, I think that that type of personal connection that leads on was what I wanted to show, and the ideas are part of the action. I know it's a long answer to your question, but I hope that makes some sense.
Oh yeah, and there's a really marvelous moment in the book, and we've skipped over, by the way, the fact that Hannah Arendt and her mother and husband were imprisoned by the French when Germany declared war, you know.
Yes.
And then, of course, they were caught in the trap when the Germans, in fact, occupied France. So all of that is an incredible story about Hannah Arendt. Got her mother and her husband out, and she even got a letter for... She even had a visa for Walter Benjamin. I believe you didn't say this in the book, but he had a position waiting for him at the New School in New York. But alas, again, this terrible stroke of bad luck and his despair. But there's a moment in New York now, post-war, where Hannah Arendt is writing, and she notices... or things she notices, maybe she hallucinates, a water stain on the ceiling, and it's in the shape of the face of Walter Benjamin, who speaks to her. Now, is this something that actually she wrote about, or did you, like, imagine this?
No, I think if she had written about that, they would have not paid attention to her. But, no, this is one of the things that I think is so wonderful about doing a comics or a graphic novel history, where we can use the medium where pictures and words can create a larger meaning that brings the reader in, you know, that sort of 1 + 1 equals 3. So I'd set up that Hannah, a big part of the way she thinks that people should think is they should have an active dialogue with themselves. So she's stuck because she has written The Origins of Totalitarianism, and she's kind of described better than almost anybody how totalitarian states rise through systematic lying and dehumanization. And it's incredible. But, you know, she wants to figure out why. And as you said before, for her, Auschwitz and all that stuff, there's an abyss. There's a break. There's a break in history. She basically says everything that happened before doesn't count, and we've got to make it all up new. So, yeah, she's thinking about Benjamin. So I set it up, and I love a pun, so I titled the scene Walter Stain. I lived in an apartment on the Upper West Side for a long time, and we used to get those kind of water stains on the ceiling, and I thought this would be a really interesting way to dramatize her internal dialogue. So it starts sort of her arguing with herself, and then she sees this Walter Benjamin image in the shape of a water stain, and she has a debate with this image about why evil happens in the world. So I think what it allowed me to do was make the thought process, the creative thought process, kind of active. And at the end of her little dialogue with Walter Benjamin, where they're kind of quipping and snipping at each other, and luckily Benjamin, since he kind of is distinctive to draw because he has like big glasses and a mustache, so he's easy to do in water stain blots. I'm glad he wasn't more complicated than that. But at the end, she sort of says to Benjamin's reflection, which is, I guess you could say, her own, you know, that's her own internal, that's a way of dramatizing her own internal thought. She says, like, so what's the answer? You know, and Benjamin says, you're going to have to figure that out for yourself. And so it turns it, you know. But, yeah, that was one of the things that, you know, as I was working in this medium, because I'm used to putting across ideas in pictures and words, that I felt so happy that I could do, you know, with this form.
Right. Oh, and it completely works. And we're talking with Ken Krimstein about his wonderful graphic biography of Hannah Arendt, The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt, A Tyranny of Truth. Now, this whole part on the origins of totalitarianism, it was a very powerful reading for me. On page 65, there's at the top of the page, it says, old answers are mute. And here she's thinking about different things and different kind of, what would you call them, little bubbles. And
yeah.
She says, not surprisingly, since this, which is, you know, the abyss, totalitarianism, this is
right.
A new phenomenon. There's no word to describe it, so I have to make one up. The new force unleashed on the world is totalitarianism. She says, before totalitarian leaders can fit reality to their lies, their message is an unrelenting contempt for facts.
Those are her words. Those are her words.
Right. I mean, this is so resonant to what is happening today in our country, in the United States, with President Trump right now.
You know, I think, first of all, she died in, you know, December of 1975. I think the brilliance is, as a person who lived through the rise of Hitler, as a person who loved language. I mean, I would say, you know, for her, and it goes on, and it even comes back when the Eichmann trial thing happens at the end, which we may or may not talk about. But like I said, for her, words are actions. So that when you lie, you're actually acting falsely. Mm-hmm. And she witnessed it. I mean, she saw at close hand, even more sort of disturbing that she witnessed. And you know, I started writing this book in 2015, in the middle of 2015. So, you know, things were very different then. I was just interested in Hannah as a profound, interesting person, you know. And then, of course, she became more and more relevant, you know, and was a comfort to me as I was reading it. And her thoughts go beyond this. But she saw how even well-meaning people, even smart, intellectual people, did not take some of this buffoonery, you know, seriously, to the point that when the Reichstag burned, which was when the gigantic capital building of Germany went on fire and the Nazis immediately blamed a fabricated stand-in person, a lot of people just, they were incredulous. And the incredulity, the disbelief, everybody, of what was happening, you know, wasn't lost on Hannah Arendt. And she documents it. And she saw how lies, when they're repeated and repeated and repeated, two things happen. And her observations are so profound, because I think she was such a great student of human nature. It isn't that we go and believe the lies so much. It's that we don't believe anything. We become sort of immune.
Exactly.
And then people can kind of just do stuff, and we're just like everything cynical. And that was what was really kind of shocking to me. And that's the beginning of the destruction of the individual freedom that she talks about.
Yeah. Right. I mean, it's really that nihilism in some way is very much at the foundation of totalitarianism.
Yeah, it's that stripping of the individual to the point where you become superfluous. You actually become superfluous. And what a horrible thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's shocking. It has to do with dignity. I mean, I do think she believed a lot in that everybody deserves dignity. So these thoughts were obviously started by that, but then I feel that she tried to push it on and try and come up with kind of a solution. I'm not sure she did or didn't. Ultimately, it was very personal, but, you know, an interesting thing, she wanted to be a provocateur. After the war, she was invited to go. She was like the first woman and the first Jew to lecture to get this big award in Germany called the Lessing Prize. And, you know, in our typical American ignorance of all things German, including myself, we barely know who Lessing is. But evidently, you know, I've talked to some people and he can look it up. He's like a very profound humanistic thinker. But in any case, she quoting Lessing saying, "I want my ideas to provoke discussion, to provoke debate." And this is what I thought was so incredible about her, you know.
She
wasn't doing it in a negative way. She wasn't like trying to make fires. She was just trying to get people to think, you
right.
know.
She calls it thinking through.
Thinking through.
Exactly. Now, one last thing, and we won't talk about Eichmann because we'll leave it up to our listeners to get your book and read it. So,
thank you, yeah.
But at the end of the book, or toward the end of the book, she says that horror or the abyss happens when private emotions enter the realm of the public space. Political questions are far too serious to be left to politicians. Deconstruct this idea for us, just as a last, to put the cap on the, you know, movement of Hannah Arendt from philosophical truth to political truth.
Yeah. Well, I think what happened was, again, as a witness to life, she saw what happened when people put emotion into the public arena. She made always a big line between what she believed in privacy and we should love and have and be very close and this and that. But when it gets to the public space, she firmly believed that we needed to be kind of almost dispassionate, respectful, respect everybody's point of view, even if it makes your skin crawl, but they have to respect yours. She saw it as I call it, a grand ongoing mess, you know, or as somebody, you know, once said to me, democracy is a horrible system, but, you know, nobody's ever thought of anything better, mm-hmm. you know. And I think this idea of when you put emotion into policy, you start getting things like, you know, I'll put it this way, you know, people who wear red bow ties are evil, you know, and they all have to be rounded up. It's like, why? What? It doesn't make any sense. Mm-hmm. So she was in her, I would say this was her Teutonic, you know, her Germanic side. It's like, we have to be dispassionate about things that we all deal with together, because we each are individuals. We each have our own point of view. But as a group, we've got to be respectful of everybody. And I think, you know, emotion tips the scale if because people can have different emotions. So I think it's a protective measure that she has. And I think you can see it. Sometimes she overdoes it, and sometimes she's maybe wrong. But she was very, one thing I would say that she was very, very afraid of, and this word is being thrown around even today, and people don't understand it, is the mob. Mm-hmm. She saw mobs. She saw how that happened. And what mobs are people who are swept up with emotion acting in a public place. Firsthand, she saw bad stuff happens when that, you know.
Right. And emotion that is being manipulated by politicians for their own gain, by demagogues.
Right.
I mean, that's often how that's how mobs happen.
Right. Emotion is extremely, you know, I love emotion. Emotion is the stuff of storytelling. Mm-hmm. But there are many stories. There are many stories that you have to listen to. And by the way, Hannah, look at what she writes about poetry. Look at what she writes about story. Look at what she writes about language. You know, look at the people who stuck with her and who loved her writing. not just non-Jews, but Jews. W.H. Auden, an amazing poet. Randall Jarrell, Selah Baron, the guy who founded the whole Jewish history studies program in the West at Columbia University. You know, people who valued the word and opposed the cliche. Mm. And that was what, you know, she was all about. So I think that's what we have to be wary of, you know, I think.
Well, you have definitely inspired me to read more by Hannah Arendt. And your book about her is The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt, A Tyranny of Truth. Ken Krimstein, it's just been such a delight to talk with you about this terrific book.
Well, I very much appreciate it, and it's been a delight to talk to you about it. You had me talking about some, we didn't even get to talk about pen, what kind of pen I used.
Well, what kind of pen did you use?
I used a rapidiograph pen. Actually, I used about 9 of them because they clog up, but I love them. Anyway,
well, that's
thanks
great.
A lot.
Ken Krimstein's cartoons have been published in The New Yorker, Punch, The National Lampoon, and elsewhere. He teaches at DePaul University and the School of the Art Institute of Chicago. Go to writersvoice.net to see images from his graphic biography, The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt. Next up, the graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2015, we spoke with British cartoonist Kate Evans about her graphic biography of a great German-Jewish woman thinker, the revolutionary leader Rosa Luxemburg. Luxemburg was a giant in the history of the political left, a leader of the German socialist workers' movement in the early 20th century, an opponent of the First World War, and a brilliant writer and speaker. Kate Evans' stunning biography about Luxemburg is Red Rosa. I started out by asking Evans why she wanted to write a book about Rosa Luxemburg. She told me she was commissioned to write the book.
I got an email saying, would you be interested in writing, drawing and perhaps writing a graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg? And I went, yes, yes, sure, and sent the email off. And it was only afterwards that I Googled who she was, which isn't very professional, really. But, oh, my gosh, I was absolutely gobsmacked, really, by how, what an amazing person to have as a subject in so many ways. She's inspirational in so many ways.
Yeah, on so many levels. I mean, she was a revolutionary. She was a economic theorist. She was a suffragette. I mean, more than that, she was a feminist. You know, she was a person of unbelievable brilliance. You say a person of audacity and courage. Tell us about Rosa Luxemburg as a person.
Well, that's an interesting question. Now, we have her letters. Verso have put out a 500-page volume of her edited letters, although they're also reproducing all of her work in full, so we will get the full letters in about 10 years' time. So that's lovely because you've got really personal documents, and she just sparkles on the page. The first letter that opens the volume there, she's writing to a friend in Switzerland, and you can just tell she's enthusiastic and interesting, engaged and witty in all these different kinds of ways. She's the person to whom I would apply the epithet indomitable, actually, because she seems to have an ability to completely ignore anything that should be holding her back. You know, she's got a severe disability. She's a woman. She's a refugee. She's Jewish. She is facing multiple handicaps. And she simply just doesn't engage with that. It also makes, I mean, it's interesting, you called her a feminist. Although she is inspirational for women, and she was certainly, you know, she certainly approved of female suffrage and equality, including sexual equality, which she practiced. She also was quite keen not to be sidelined into women's issues. I think at one point she was offered a prominent position within the German Social Democratic Party in charge of female suffrage, and she didn't want anything to do with it because she realised quite rightly that it meant that she would be sidelined from her actual specialism, which was economic theory and Marxist analysis.
That's true. But she also, at least in your book, she does make the point over and over again within the party that women should vote, or that, in fact, the party was kind of shooting itself in the foot by not having women vote.
Oh, yeah, she would definitely engage with issues that are a feminist concern. And if you read some of her writings on women, she writes very sympathetically about proletarian working women. In a way, I think you have to be a woman to make that connection. But she had a bit of a critical distance from the women's suffrage movement at the time because it had very limited aims. If you look at the way that women's suffrage progressed here in the UK, that firstly the vote was given to upper-class women, property-holding women over the age of 30, which is an incredibly small subsection of the female population at the time. But that was the way that it achieved its aims. It was first the upper-class women got the vote, and only later was it extended to working-class women. And I mean, given that the working classes massively outnumber the upper classes, it makes sense for socialists to press very strongly for women's suffrage. So she supported it in that way. But she was a little bit... I don't think she had any time for upper-class feminists who had very limited and very very gradual liberal ideas, because for her it was all about absolute equality and absolute social change, and tackling the root problems of capitalism at their core, not just tinkering with the edges.
We're listening back to extended excerpts from my 2015 interview with Kate Evans about her graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Evans is a social justice activist herself. She told me that researching Luxemburg's life gave her a greater understanding of the accomplishments of the socialist movements of her time and how they connect with the kind of activism Evans is involved with today.
So it's been a great joy to go back and discover the history of resistance and just to really be inspired by how much socialism achieved in the late 19th and early 20th century.
Well, so say more about that and also about Rosa Luxemburg's, how she moved Marxist theory forward, how she actually had a theory of globalization and the reason for it. Connect the dots for us between, you know, what Marx was saying and what she was, you know, agreeing with in terms of Marx, and then how she really pushed it forward, because it seems that it's very relevant to where we are today.
She was thinking about capitalism from first principles. This was at a time when there wasn't such a concept as sort of GDP, gross domestic product. There weren't very many of the economics tools that we have nowadays to think about how nations and how the globe interacts in capitalist terms. Now, she was building on the work of previous economists and Marx, and in The Accumulation of Capital, which is her masterwork, she was addressing the idea that Marx was addressing in Volume 2 of Capital. Now, in that, he envisages that capitalism is a closed system in which everyone is either a worker or a boss. So that's his theoretical point. Rosa Luxemburg takes that and proves that mathematically, if you have money circulating in a closed system within capitalism, then there's nowhere for it to go. Because the workers are working all the time, but they can't have any extra money because they're being exploited to the absolute maximum. The capitalists are extracting as much money from the workers as they can, and then they're producing these products, but then the products then need to be sold to someone. Now, what we've had in the 20th century is an explosion of consumerism, and we're just about to have Christmas, so you can see that on the shelves of the shops, where people go out and buy insane amounts of stuff, and that's what fuels capitalism. But the point is, if you only get your money from within capitalism, where does that money come from? So capitalism can't be a closed system. This is what she proves. And so it has to be parasitic upon non-capitalist systems. And so you get a very clear idea that capitalism is a bit like a sort of a cancer that feeds off anything that's non-exploitative and extracts value from it, from human labour and from the environment. And that was a really stunning realisation. The Accumulation of Capital was partly owing to sexism, extremely badly received by other socialists. She was starting to really annoy many of the other men in this German Social Democracy Party, as far as I can see, because some of them fancied her and she didn't want to go out with them. But so, I mean, the extent to which socialism at the time didn't realise didn't get that capitalism is bound up with expansionism and with the military-industrial complex, and Rosa did, can be seen in the fact that the German Social Democracy Party, which was the biggest party in the German Reichstag at the time, failed to oppose the First World War. They couldn't see that the First World War was an imperial war of expansion, and Rosa Luxemburg could. And she is the one prominent figure who consistently, from the outset of the war, opposed it. She was joined by Karl Liebknecht, and their stories are generally told together. They were both very famous for opposing the First World War and forming the Spartacists. So she had this very, very deep theoretical understanding of the problems of capitalism, and she wasn't very easily co-opted or swayed from those, which is really refreshing.
Yes. She also tackled head on the issue, the question of reform or revolution. She did that as early as, I think, when she went to Switzerland and was reading Eduard Bernstein. But then it really came much more to a head when she, in the struggles in the German SPD, because she'd gone to Berlin. Talk about her take on this whole question, reform versus revolution.
She said there's nothing separating socialism from just liberal reformism if you're not committed to revolution, because if you're just tinkering at the edges of the system, there's no difference between you and the capitalists themselves. So I think she says it's more or less like if you're posing the question reform or revolution, the question is to be or not to be. Without revolution, social democracy ceases to exist. Now, I don't agree with all of Luxemburg's. I mean, I think there's an extent to which 19th century revolutionaries romanticised revolution, and they could be critiqued for not really having very much in place that was going to work at the point when revolution had happened. And that certainly is the story of German social democracy after the German Revolution. But I do think that it's admirable in its unwavering opposition to the problems of capitalism and its analysis of the problems of capitalism. Mm.
Now, when you say the German Revolution, are you referring to, what, the 1920s? There was, what are you referring to there in the German?
The bit in 1918, when the First World War ends, which they taught me about in school, and they said, and then the First World War ended and there was an armistice. And they don't say, and then the First World War ended because their working people all over Germany rose up and overthrew the cities and took to the streets and kicked out the government and deposed the Kaiser and instituted a socialist government. That's not the thing that they mention. I mean, people in Germany now, you'll say, and the German Revolution, and they'll go, yeah, well, what revolution? Because it achieved so little, really. I mean, the Weimar government achieved some progressive aims. And the way that the socialists came onto the streets and defeated the Beer Hall Putsch of 1924 is really outstanding. But when it came to it, there was a power vacuum, and then business as usual rushed to take its place.
I asked Kate Evans whether Rosa Luxemburg might think reform or revolution would be necessary today as we confront such crises as climate change. In other words, is there a place for evolution on the way to revolution?
Well, I'm personally of the opinion that change is change. And I mean, she's very clear on her reform or revolution, which is not letting go of the idea of revolution as the goal that everyone should be working towards. And when she's talking about revolution, she's talking about radical system change. But it's also a very, very democratic idea in Luxemburgism. She's committed to, oh, there's just a marvellous quote. I'm sorry, I have to find it for you. History is not making things easy for us. A bourgeois revolution could simply overthrow the official power and replace it with a couple of new men. But we must work from the bottom to the top. We can only come to power with the clear and explicit will of the great majority of the proletarian masses. So she's committed to the idea that everybody is into the idea of social change. And maybe that is possible. We have such incredible horizontalism with modern means of communicating that I do think we now have the potential for much quicker much quicker shifts in public opinions and ideas than anybody has ever seen before. I think the way that the Arab Spring took off across large parts of the Middle East, and it's quite impressive, really, that people now have a way of organising, which has got real revolutionary potential. You know, I mean, it seems like capitalism is the neoliberal project is brooking no opposition, and it's sort of running away with itself. And it's creating a vast disenfranchised, disillusioned middle class who are steadily getting poorer because the 1% is sucking all the wealth in towards itself like a massive black hole. I don't think that's sustainable. I do think we are going to see change. I hope it's progressive social change.
I asked Kate Evans to talk about how she tackled communicating Rosa Luxemburg's complex economic and political ideas in graphic form in her biography, Red Rosa.
The process consisted of I read through her letters, and then I read through her work, and then I tried to find all the tiny little tweetable bits of her work that summed up things that seemed important about, say, her opinions on the mass strike or her opinions on opportunism or whatever the theme was. And then I found that the storyline quite organically sprang from that, and I could kind of see it like a film in my head. Now, the fun thing about writing a cartoon book rather than writing a novel is that I basically got to draw that film. Rather than doing sort of a straight biography, I got to create fictionalized scenes between people using actual words from the people involved. But I can change the setting. I mean, if I wanted to be completely, strictly faithful to life, what we would have is a cartoon book of Rosa Luxemburg sitting at a desk writing a letter to someone saying something. So instead of that, I would take, say, some really groovy bits from a letter to Leo Jogesch's, her lover, and instead of having her writing it in a letter to him, I'd have them having a naked pillow fight just to make it a little bit more interesting. She's got some just brilliant quotes like, "I must take you in my claws and terrorise you completely. I have the right to do this because I'm 10 times better than you." And she's just brilliant. Really, really beautiful little phrases. So there's sort of three elements to the bits that make up the work. There's the explication, the bits where I'm trying to explain her concept of Marxism and of capitalism and inequality. And then there's the personal story where I'm sort of finding the drama that's there in her story of who she's with and how they reacted and what they all did. And then there are these little gems that are there in her letters, which are the most sublime bits of writing, where she's describing, say, the swallows flying over the prison yard where she's indefinitely imprisoned for opposing the First World War, or the clouds above the rooftops back when she was a girl gazing out of her bedroom window. And they're just little poetic jewels. And I knew as soon as I'd read those that just those on their own would be just beautiful things to pin together and create a story around. So I was so lucky. She's really inspirational. Her words are really beautiful. And her work's really, really important.
We're talking with cartoonist Kate Evans about her graphic biography of the great revolutionary thinker and activist Rosa Luxemburg. It's called Red Rosa. You talked about Kate Evans. You talk in the book about how she was arrested indefinitely. It wasn't the first time that she went to prison. She also had a really tragic end. And here, this also comes really alive on the page. Talk about how she died and how it was for you to write that, to draw that.
The page where she dies, I've saved the Photoshop file with the title Nasty, Nasty, Nasty. I just found it really hard. Always the job of the writer, of the graphic biographer, is to find the drama within a scene. And so, you know, I had her last words, which were, "Don't shoot." And I thought, hang on, she's actually ordering them there not to shoot. And I think that's quite profound. She didn't give in right to the end. But then I find a way of framing that within the book, because maybe her death, I mean, it's tragic and sad, but maybe it's not the end of all the stories. There's a lot of new beginnings coming on from Rosa Luxemburg's work. So I hope I give a sense of continuity about that.
So the relevance for today, you say, what is still going on?
Well, Rosa Luxemburg was a theorist of revolution, so she would go out on the streets and interview people and ask them what motivated them to do the mass uprisings that they were involved in. She's got a lovely... It's interesting. Luxemburg's writing at a time where Marx has more or less said that revolution is preordained, that the workers must join together because it just makes sense that they will, and they will rise up because that's what workers do. I mean... He hadn't foreseen anything like the systems they have in China, whereby migrant workers only get to work in a factory for 3 years and then get booted out before they have a chance to develop any kind of solidarity. Obviously, capitalism's been a bit cleverer than Marx ever gave it credit for. But at that point, so people seem to think, well, socialism's just bound to happen. A revolution's just bound to happen. We just know that this is all going to collapse. Now, I think Luxemburg's right. It probably is going to collapse. It's whether it collapses into something better is the burning question. So she's struggling with this idea of the preordained scientific progressive march of history towards glorious revolution, and alternatively the idea, well, what if that isn't going to happen? And so she gets very interesting ideas about spontaneity and the way that really radical social change can sweep through a place. And those her writings on the mass strike and on spontaneity are still relevant today. And you can draw direct parallels between, say, the Egyptian revolution, which had its roots in striking action, and the way that, and her analysis of what happened in Russia in 1905. The links between the bit in Accumulation of Capital, where she's talking about the link between militarism and globalisation and capitalism, is incredibly prescient. The way that capitalism keeps expanding to fill every kind of non-capitalist space is nowadays, we can see that kind of primary accumulation occurring within capitalist countries as well as back when it was all about imperial expansion in Luxembourg's time. But now you can see the way that every kind of non-capitalist strata of society, like, for example, over here, the British health system is being taken over by capitalist corporate healthcare systems. It's being dismantled and privatised. The way that public utilities have been wholesale privatised within the last 30 years around the globe. And that is all primary accumulation. So it's incredibly prescient the way that she analyses quite how sort of unstoppably rampant capitalism is and how that's part of its mathematical raison d'etre. There isn't a way for it to not be like that.
Well, this is a terrific book. You really make Rosa Luxemburg into such a vivid, alive, full individual. And this has just been a fascinating conversation, Kate Evans. Your book is Red Rosa, A Graphic Biography of Rosa Luxemburg. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And that was Kate Evans talking about her graphic biography of Rosa Luxemburg, Red Rosa. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Then check out my blog, Francesca Rhiannon at blogspot.com. You can find lots of cool stuff there. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.